Good morning. I will first note that Justice Pfeiffer is en route and will be joining us. And we will start with case 08-2251, State of Ohio versus Dante Chambliss. The appellant, Stephen Bradley.
Chief Justice O'Connor.
Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Bradley. I'll be arguing the matter on behalf of all three defendant appellants in this case. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. The issue before the court today is whether revised code section 2505.02 allows for an interlocutory appeal in circumstances where an individual has been denied their right to counsel of their choice. And in this instance, revised code section 2505.02 sets forth a three-prong criteria as to whether a issue is considered a final appealable order. And the parties have agreed that the only prong of that three-prong test at issue is whether the post-conviction appeal would be meaningful or effective. And it is appellant's position that, in simple terms, a post-conviction appeal is not meaningful or effective for any number of reasons. And in no particular order of significance, the United States Supreme Court in U.S. versus Gonzalez-Lopez somewhat evolved the court's view on the significance of trial counsel's role in the proceedings. And they effectively determined that the trial counsel's role is one that permeates every aspect of a trial.
Well, they held it was structural error, didn't they?
They did, in fact, hold it as structural error.
So if it's structural error, why would a trial court do it?
I'm sorry?
If it is structural error, why would a trial judge remove retained counsel in a criminal case?
Well, quite candidly, I don't know that I could answer the question, why would they do it? In this particular instance, for example, trial counsel were removed for, I believe, no legitimate reason whatsoever.
Is there a transcript of that removal?
There is.
And what was the court's basis?
There was no basis offered whatsoever. The issue at the trial court level was on the date of trial, there had not been a search warrant affidavit that had been unsealed despite requests by the defense, and in defense counsel expressing to the court in simple terms, we need access to that search warrant affidavit before we could proceed with a trial. The court became frustrated.
Three defendants were being tried jointly.
That is correct.
Did each make the same motion or did only one?
All three defendants.
All three did.
That's correct.
And the court, did the court grant the motion?
No. In fact, just so we're clear, there was, in fact, in essence, boilerplate motion to suppress the evidence filed, and cited in the motion was the fact that without access to the sealed search warrant affidavit, it would be defense counsel would be unable to advance those issues.
But the court then removed all three retained counsel for the criminal defendants.
That is correct.
And do we need to reach the question of whether it is or isn't structural error in this case?
Well, I think that's been satisfied by the Supreme Court in Gonzalez-Lopez that it
is. So you think it is?
There's no question.
And the singular question then is whether or not it becomes a final appealable order.
That is correct.
But the U.S. Supreme Court has said and the federal circuits say it is not. It is an interlocutory order and may not be appealed. So you conduct the first trial. And if the defendants prevail, the matter is concluded. And if they don't, it would seem as though there would be a retrial almost automatic. Is that your understanding of the federal jurisdiction?
It is, although the I believe you're referring to Flanagan or Flanagan versus United States and the Supreme Court level, and then Keenan with respect to the state court level. And Flanagan actually addressed a comparable but significantly different federal statute that was much more restrictive on, in terms of what would and would not be subjected or the subject of an interlocutory appeal.
But the federal courts don't permit interlocutory appeals or an appeal on the on removal of counsel.
Well, the only decision on that issue is Flanagan, and that, of course, 20 years predates the Supreme Court's decision in Gonzales-Lopez.
Mr. Bradley, if I could turn you to the proposition, when you talk about counsel of choice, the denial of counsel of choice, we're talking specifically about retained counsel, correct?
There's no question.
Just
about
want to
that.
Clarify that if an individual is appointed counsel and this situation were to happen, we'd be in a different position altogether. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct, Your Honor.
All right.
And to the real issue of whether there can be a meaningful or effective appeal post-conviction, there's no question that by virtue of the Supreme Court's ruling in Gonzales-Lopez, specifically that trial counsel, their tactics, their choices, their approach so permeates every aspect of the trial proceedings in manners that are very real but not quantifiable. And ultimately, those decisions by default counsel, if you will, would necessarily have profound impact on a retrial.
Counsel, in your response to Justice Lanziger, and based on what you just said, why is there a distinction between retained counsel and counsel for court-appointed counsel?
Well, I think the distinction would be that
at this point, I mean, use the comparison of this case. You're saying that, you know, the retained counsel were unlawfully removed from the participation and representation of this case. And what if at this juncture you would have had court-appointed counsel making the same motions for all three?
Well,
what's the distinction there?
The distinction there being that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel contemplates counsel of your choice in circumstances where you can either A, afford counsel of your own choice, or B, there's somebody that's willing to represent you without adequate funding. In situations where somebody's court-appointed counsel, then appointed counsel, the law does not contemplate that they can pick and choose so long as that counsel meets effective assistance of counsel.
So the
standards.
Basis for the removal has nothing to do with it, in your mind, for appointed or retained counsel?
I think in situations there is a distinction to be drawn, that if somebody has retained counsel of their choice, then they have a constitutional right to be represented by that person, whereas in a situation where they're court-appointed.
But you would agree under certain circumstances, based on the behavior of the retained counsel, there may be legitimate reasons for the court to disqualify that counsel from representation.
Are you referring specifically in this case?
No, I'm
just
talking
in general
sense. We are looking at something a little bigger than just
yes.
your case.
Sure. It is not that is correct, that there are certain circumstances where the court has the inherent power or authority to remove counsel of choice. However, those situations, I think, are very narrow, and that in the event that there is in this case, an interlocutory appeal, that issue can be addressed. And if it's determined that the removal was not proper, then, of course, we have a structural error that's been committed, and counsel in that case would be reinstated.
Counsel, I think your argument is that that this is a provisional remedy. And I think the state even conceded that, but actually I'm having a little difficulty with that. Why do you consider this a provisional remedy? It seems to me that if every side issue becomes a provisional remedy, which entitles it to an interlocutory appeal, that the exceptions are going to swallow the rule.
I don't believe so. I believe that most of the issues that are traditionally subject to a post-conviction appeal would remain the subject of a post-conviction appeal. In this situation, the right to counsel of choice has not only been deemed to be structural error, but again, has such a profound impact on the trial and matters that, in manners that can't be quantifiable, and it seems that this would be an ideal situation to resolve quickly, expeditiously, prior to the start of a trial, given the fact that a reversal in a situation where the removal was improper would be virtually automatic, and in that situation, there would have been what amounts to be a meaningless exercise of a first trial where you would have victims.
Well, not necessarily. The scenario would be that the judge removes the trial counsel of first choice, and for whatever reason that the trial court may think is valid, the defendants may select counsel of second choice. And those counsel may, in fact, resolve the issue to the satisfaction of the defendants, and they decide that they actually got representation that they wanted, even though it wasn't their first choice. And that resolves the issue, no appeal.
Well, the answer to that would, I guess, be maybe. I mean, it's so speculative and presumptuous that the defendant in that situation would be in a position to retains second substitute counsel that he or she would be satisfied with. And regardless, that second counsel would be, by definition, their second choice. And a defendant, ideally, should be able to freely exercise his Sixth Amendment right to counsel of his first choice.
Mr. Bradley, you're well into your reserved time.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Freeman.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the Court, Warren Freeman, on behalf of William Mason and the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. Obviously, I'm going to ask this Court follow its precedent in Keenan and follow the United States Supreme Court precedent in Flanagan, finding that appeals from the denial of counsel after conviction are neither impracticable nor ineffective, and those rights can be adequately vindicated on direct appeal following a conviction.
Counsel, how are they not inadequate? You're talking about going through an entire trial, almost certain reversal, and sending it back to the trial court again. You have wasted innumerable trial court resources, and you're putting the defendant through a second trial. How is that not inadequate when here you're talking about what could be a 4 to 5 month delay, and we could proceed without having to duplicate efforts?
First off, to the delay issue, it in my experience in the 8th District Court of Appeals, it's not going to be 4 or 5 months. It's going to be 6 to 8, if not a year. So there's going to be a delay from the perspective, even if this interlocutory appeal is allowed.
So who is better able to handle that, though, the state or the defendant? So if it's a structural error, as the United States Supreme Court has declared, and we have to come back for a second trial, there is that same delay, and shouldn't the state bear that versus the defendant?
That's a fair analysis, but the statute only requires meaningful and effective review. And to the extent that the appeal will result in reversal, I do not concede that this necessarily was error here by the trial court judge. But assuming that it is error, it will result in reversal. And in Keenan, this court at page 179 cites to Flanagan at page 268. And Justice O'Connor, writing for a unanimous United States Supreme Court, talks about three situations where there is going to be per se prejudice that's going to require reversal. That's a Feretta violation, which is the denial of self-representation, a Gideon violation, which is the denial of counsel altogether, and then a Holloway versus Arkansas violation, which is a defense attorney's request to be removed because he has a conflict with co-defendants. Every one of those situations will result in automatic prejudice. There is no ineffective claim to be reviewed. And Justice O'Connor, writing for that court, said, because it's going to be reversed, the appeal is automatically effective. And when the legislature passed the amendments in 1998 and amended 2505-02 on this court's actually request in an opinion in 1997 and added B4, more specifically today B4B, they wrote meaningful and effective. And at that time, there's a 1994 opinion from this court and a 1984 opinion from the United States Supreme Court saying that denial of counsel of choice results in meaningful and effective appeals. In this case, they have simply moved this type of error, the denial of counsel of choice, into one of those three errors discussed in Justice O'Connor's opinion. Excuse me, that's a Feretta violation, a Gideon violation, or a Holloway violation.
Well, on appeal, what is going to be the standard? What would it take to get a reversal?
The standard is, did the trial court abuse its discretion in erroneously dismissing retained counsel? You look at the facts, and the appeals court, two judges would say, you know, this court went beyond, it was a capricious decision, it's not based on the record, it is an abuse of discretion, therefore it's erroneous. That's going to result in that automatic reversal of that trial. And then any other issues that can still be raised, sufficiency of the evidence, will still be allowed to be litigated. Any potential 404B issues that were allowed to come into trial will still be litigated. None of those issues become moot in that direct appeal. That appeal.
Mr. Bradley tells us that the transcript doesn't have any basis for what the trial judge did here in removing three lawyers who were retained by these defendants. What does your view of the transcript show?
I would disagree with that. The judge believed, whether right or wrong, he believed this, and I don't think he may have been wrong, but I don't believe he abused his discretion. He believed that defense counsel was attempting to build in a claim of ineffective assistance that would result in automatic reversal. And he said as much to those defense attorneys.
Well, the lawyer said, if I don't get a chance to examine the affidavit, I can't be effective for my client.
And
I have to know what the information is so that I know what the proper defense would be.
I understand.
How is that building in a defense? Isn't it just discharging your duty as an attorney to represent your client?
I think that's one view of it, but the trial court took a different view under the circumstances. The trial court had been involved in all the pretrials, knew about the plea process, allowed these defendants to withdraw their plea. This trial judge was intimately involved from indictment to the day that these attorneys were dismissed, and based on everything that he had seen in defense counsel's statements that if you make me go to trial today, I'm going to be ineffective, he believed that that was improper, and they were trying to build in that claim of automatic reversal on direct appeal should one or all three
be convicted. Happens when the next trial counsel makes the same motion for the same information about the sealed document, and is the judge going to remove that next counsel as well?
I can't speak to that issue.
That's your argument here, is that the judge viewed this tactic as a facade to build in an ineffective assistance of counsel, when the attorney, based on the very limited record that is had been developed here, wants to put on the record, I can't defend my client if I can't get access to this information. And quite frankly, the access to the fact that the prosecutor did not want the name disclosed was the basis for the plea negotiation initially that fell through. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Counsel, is there or should there be any difference in the standard of the final appealable order between civil cases and criminal cases?
In the federal system, there is no difference. It's never a final appealable order. Ohio has recognized the distinction. That goes back to the Russell case. This court discussed at length the unquantifiable way that despite a verdict for or against you, you know, how do we determine the appropriate amount of damages this attorney wouldn't have been able to succeed in a plaintiff's case or this defense attorney would have been able to defend against? And then how do we determine prejudice in that prong? And that obviously was ultimately reaffirmed several years ago, and that's the standard here. With that being said, this court has the determinant in interpreting that statute to make that distinction. And that, again, that distinction is based on a Third Circuit case from the federal system, which ultimately gets overruled by the United States Supreme Court. But there is a difference there. And again, it's criminal law or a criminal trial is quantifiable. Usually if a defendant is guilty after a trial, I'm going to get involved because there's going to be an appeal. It's very rare that the trial is not appealed. It's not so in the civil context. The money damages may be sufficient. There may not be money to litigate an appeal. There's any number of reasons that denial of civil counsel of choice is different than criminal counsel of choice. And to the extent there isn't a legitimate difference, I would posit to this court that the remedy is not to make this case a final appealable order, but in fact to change this court's precedent in the civil context to match the federal precedent.
We don't have a case in front of us that's going to, you know, put that on our table today, thank God. The question, you know, you just enumerated some of the damages that a civil party may be exposed to if the judge removes the counsel of choice. And you said, you know, the inability to appeal because of lack of funds, et cetera. Well, here, these were privately retained attorneys, presumably paid up to that point. What happens if the defendant has no more money to go to, you know, the second string attorney? Mm-hmm. All right. So they then have to be a burden on the taxpayer to have court-appointed attorney represent them, correct?
Correct.
And that's okay?
That's their I do not have a problem with indigent clients or an indigent defendant, no matter at which point they become indigent, needing representation. That's a right guarantee to all indigent
defendants.
Well, I'm
not saying that, you know, from your perspective. I'm saying from the defendant's perspective, you know, and how does that meet the needs of the defendant?
Again, I don't believe the defendant's perspective is necessarily the key here. The issue is whether the direct appeal provides a meaningful or effective remedy. It does. The case is going to, if in fact counsel is erroneously dismissed, result in automatic reversal. They will get their day in court, and they will get their day in court with the retained attorney.
Whose burden is it to demonstrate the erroneous removal, in your view? Does the defendant carry that burden to the appellate court, or is it the state's responsibility to show no prejudice?
Well, prejudice isn't an analysis once counsel is erroneously removed, but
well, you are assuming counsel is erroneously removed. I'm asking you, who has to demonstrate that?
The appellant always has to demonstrate that in a court of appeals.
So you have a burden now on a defense counsel to show that his counsel was erroneously removed in the appellate court. Is that your view?
That's correct. And, I mean, the burden was on the appellant in Gonzalez-Lopez itself, and they found that the appellant had met its burden because there was no legitimate reason to deny pro hoc status to a criminal defendant who had been a criminal attorney who had been given it many times in that court itself.
Well,
there was no
the appellate court in this case wrote, they described the action of the trial court as the unilateral removal of retained counsel by the court without the request of either party, without notice, without the opportunity to be heard, rendering the appellants under indictment, remanded them to jail without bond, and wholly without counsel. Is that what occurred here?
Yeah, Your Honor,
that
I don't.
Enough
I can't
to demonstrate reversal in your view.
This case may present a situation where a number of judges on an appellate court.
I guess
court
I'm
find
asking you in the description of what the appellate court wrote. Is that sufficient to demonstrate reversal in your view?
Based on the facts, I will defend the judge's actions should that time come. I believe that he had a right, based on the record that was before him, to determine that these defense attorneys were attempting to build in a claim of ineffective. We may lose this case. I don't dispute that. But this is one case. As Justice O'Connor talked about, we need to look at it in the broad spectrum of things. Most of these dismissals occur because the state has moved to dismiss counsel because of conflicts of interest. This court addressed that exact issue in Keenan.
It did. And let me read what I dissented. You tell me why I'm wrong. A post-conviction appeal does not offer Keenan an adequate remedy at law, nor does it suit an orderly and an efficient judicial system. The question of Keenan's right to counsel of his choice is necessarily most critical prior to the beginning of trial. A post-conviction appeal may offer a remedy, but not an adequate one. The choice of counsel is fundamental and impacts the entirety of the case. And that was a death case, and we had already reversed Keenan's conviction based on a prosecutor stabbing the knife into the counsel table at the trial.
There are a couple issues, Judge, Justice Viper. One, with all due respect, six members of this court disagreed with you in nine.
Well, Craig didn't. He concurred. He said because he felt compelled to follow precedent, but he didn't agree that it was a good precedent in this case.
Nine justices of the United States Supreme Court have found the appeals effective. The issue of whether it's effective or not is necessitated on what the chances of success on appeal can be. And Justice O'Connor is clear in that in Flanagan. And to the extent you're going to get a reversal, and it's more certain now, it's more certain after Gonzalez-Lopez than it was before, your Sixth Amendment right will be vindicated. And I'll point out to this court, every member of this court in the subsequent appeal of Mr. Keenan's trial found that counsel was properly removed for the conflict of interest. That was a unanimous
right.
decision.
Yeah, I mean, there was a clear conflict in that case, and perhaps that drove the outcome in Keenan, because we could see that.
But and that's why we should not be locking down criminal trials.
Because Mancino had represented the other co-defendants, had he not, in the earlier trials?
Correct. They both had represented Joe D'Ambrosio at some point in the litigation. But, again, these issues should not lock down criminal trials. It's been said repeatedly by the United States Supreme Court that delay is an anathem to criminal procedure. And that's what this will result in. No matter how frivolous the motion is, no matter you clearly have a conflict and you get removed, you can take an appeal and lock down any trial for a number of months.
Counsel, how often does this happen, where the court from the bench will remove counsel of choice?
It's extremely rare, and that's why, I believe this case should be dismissed as improvidently allowed.
Well, isn't maybe the flip side of that? It's so rare that any burden on the system that you're talking about in the form of delay can be sustained by the system.
It can be, but the question becomes, is the review meaningful and effective or effective under the statute? This court has already held that it is. The United States Supreme Court has held that it is. I see that I've gone over my time. I would ask that the decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bradley, you have 3.5 minutes.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Bradley, could you address Keenan? Because that is the case that the prosecutor is relying on.
Keenan, first of all, was decided prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Gonzalez-Lopez. And that's significant to the extent that in Gonzalez-Lopez really evolves the court's views on the significance of the right to counsel of choice and identifying it as structural error, unquantifiable but yet significant. And Keenan also, at the time it was decided, relied on the Supreme Court's decision in Flanagan versus United States, and Flanagan was interpreting a different statutory scheme than Ohio's 250502, and the statutory scheme that was considered in Flanagan was very narrow in scope on what would be considered a final appealable order and only contemplated matters that would effectively be unreviewable, the issue of bond, for example. So I believe that Keenan and Flanagan really are not applicable to the real issue before the court today. I quite frankly believe that Keenan was wrongly decided, and I think that that is the key distinctions. Number one, not a dealing with the same statutory scheme. Number two, does not take into consideration Gonzalez-Lopez.
Thank you.
I also couldn't disagree more with counsel's statement that a reversal is automatically effective or by definition effective. And for any number of reasons, I completely disagree with that. Chief Justice O'Connor, your remarks about in the event that somebody were to have retained counsel and be forced to hire second team counsel, if you will, taking it one step further, an individual could very well be in a situation where they've went through a trial that ultimately is determined where their original counsel was improperly removed. The trial would be automatically, or the conviction would be reversed, and somebody could very well be in a situation where they've exhausted their resources at that point and would definitely be denied counsel of their choice.
Well, doesn't it also go further than that? Because the proceedings in the first trial, if the original counsel is deemed to have been erroneously removed, and then you're on deck for a second trial, what was, you know, the subject matter of the first trial, witness statements, strategy, et cetera, may be very different than how the original first attorney, who's now the third attorney for, you know, would have tried the case, but pretty much the cat's out of the bag at that point, and it affects the strategy that would be employed potentially.
I don't think there's any question about that, and I believe that's probably the singularly most significant reason why a post-conviction appeal is not adequate, because witnesses would have been subjected to cross-examination. There could be, for example, prior inconsistent statements that they would be confronting with initially, et cetera. So I do believe that that is the singularly most important reason why the post-conviction appeal is not effective or adequate.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We would ask that the court reverse the judgment of the trial court.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our opinion.